Okay, this is side two of session number 32, recorded on March 11th, 2007. And Scott's going to finish his idea about Bush.
Yeah, I was just saying that this radio host made a comment that Bush wants to increase troops in the Middle East. You know, the House is against it, the Senate's against it, all the Democrats, half his own Republican Party is against it, the whole world's against it, 80% of the Americans are against it. He says, oh, he'll probably just shrug his shoulders and do it anyway.
Yeah, he's off the grid. We're all stuck inside the grid.
It's almost like, I don't know if this is a fair analogy or not, but it's almost like he thinks it's all his dream and we're all incidental anyway, so.
Right, well, that's he's expressing YouTube. People get on there and express their own stuff. They don't have to listen to anybody else. So when I use the word grid, it's not a metallic grid. It's a very subtle, seductive, participatory grid. And grid's not even the right word.
Oh.
But Bush represents, he's the image of everybody no longer matching with anybody else. Just projecting their own vision. That's the YouTube world.
Okay, so I just got a nuance of what you mean about the YouTube. You are putting yourself out there. You create something, you put it out there. You don't have to be concerned about feedback because you're not even interested. You're just putting yourself out there.
Yeah, it's panic production. Mm. You're producing content.
Yeah.
In a panic mode, as Croker calls it. So let's go into the inventory of panic themes and panic situations, the next quote, which is on page 86 of my book,
right,
on the left-hand side of the book, and it starts off with a definition of what is postmodernism. So this quote is from, just get the pages, it's part of the introduction, it's part 2 to 7, but it's Roman numeral 2 to Roman numeral 7. Whereas the quote we just did last week and this week is Roman numeral 1 and 2. So this continues from what, we've already exegeted.
Yeah, we're just going to do one or two paragraphs at a time.
Right. So let's do the first two, what is postmodernism, and then panic politics.
Right.
Which won't... Yeah, you can do two paragraphs maybe of it. Of the theme, panic politics.
Yeah, okay. It begins with the question, what is postmodernism? And I think before we can even discuss what is postmodernism, we need to be able to contrast it. We need to understand something about what modernism is. Because what's a post if you don't know what the thing is you're talking about? And I brought up in the Wikipedia, I just typed in modernism, and it shows this is not literature, movie making, architecture. This is just, it just shows artists that we can all relate to. It shows there's a picture of a Pablo Picasso and Toulouse-Lautrec painting.
All right, so modernism is Gutenberg.
Uh-huh.
All the Gutenbergian industrial arts. Postmodernism deals with the electric age.
Oh, okay.
That's why some people say McLuhan was the first postmodern prophet. Donald Thiel says that Fenwick's Wake is at least postmodern, but he prefers the term paramodern, because a lot of modernism or late radical modernism was dealing with the electric effect.
Right.
So there's always been an argument about when modernism starts and begins. So,
well, just to look at these painters who were mutated by the electronic environment, goes from Picasso to Toulouse-Lautrec, the famous painting The Scream by Edvard Munch. Marc Chagall shows something called I Am the Village, which is a merging montage. Marcel Duchamp, Fountain, and then it includes Andy Warhol's Campbell's Soup Can.
Okay, so these are artists in the electric postmodern age, but they're showing Gutenbergian artifacts, paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Painting had a crisis as soon as the electric age started.
So we wouldn't say that Andy Warhol was a postmodernist, even though he was doing...
No, he's a postmodernist, but they're describing, these are images for modernism, right?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that what this is under the category, modernism?
Right.
And Warhol's more postmodern, but the point is they're showing the medium of paint.
Mm-hmm.
Of fine art. That's a modernist artifact.
Right.
So they're showing the changes it went through under the eventual postmodern electric environment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's showing paintings. So the modernist is the period of the creative genius, the individualist genius. Thompson writes about this.
Here, let me just read the definition of modernism in Webster. Modern character, quality of thought, expression, technique. When he waxes philosophical, he comes across as a strange mix of nostalgia and modernism. Okay, then the sub-things are a style or movement in the arts that aims to break with classical and traditional forms, and a movement towards modifying traditional beliefs in accordance with modern ideas, especially Roman Catholic Church in the late 19th and 20th centuries.
Right, so early that's the industrial literate moving past the classical, which is based on the manuscript culture.
Mm-hmm.
So the Gutenberg and Kinetic industrial phase, I mean, it's with the rise of industry that the artist finally has enough of a paying public to create his own scene and not be a patron to a king or something.
Right. So, yeah, so what's the classical tradition which precedes the modern tradition?
Manuscript culture, Roman Catholic Church sponsored, king sponsored,
mm-hmm.
king as patron, feudal lords as patrons.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, Michelangelo worked for the Vatican.
Oh,
Sistine Chapel.
Right.
So then, when you get into the 1700s and 1800s, artists now, there's enough of a mass uniform public caused by the printing press that they can make a living selling their art to a public, not to a overlord.
Mm-hmm.
So the overlord culture is classical, and the bourgeois middle-class culture is modernist. And then the mass mind, electric, discarnate culture is postmodern. So let's look at what he... look at how Crowther defines postmodernism. Read that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I know, McLuhan got a lot from Pound and Eliot, and I'm looking up, you know, I Googled modernism, and it shows here in poetry, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, they were categorized as radical modernists.
Mm-hmm.
But the critics didn't know what they were responding to. They didn't understand the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It was McLuhan who clarified what the radical modernists, Lewis, Joyce, Eliot, and Pound, were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They were responding to the electric age.
Right.
You didn't get taught that if you took English in the 60s or 70s. They didn't tell you that's what Pound was doing.
Right. Okay, just one more sentence on modernist writers tended to see themselves as... Okay, modernist literature is characterized chiefly by rejection of 19th century values, and you said that the White House is an image of the 19th century. So a rejection of 19th century traditions and of their consensus between author and reader, conventions of realism or traditional meter. Modernist writers tend to see themselves as avant-garde, disengaged from Bourgeois values, and disturb their readers by adopting complex and difficult new forms and styles. In fiction, the accepted community of chronicle development was upset by Joseph Conrad, Marcel Proust, William Faulkner, while James Joyce and Virginia Woolf attempted new ways of tracing the flow of characters.
Right, so what you have is the modernist, solitary, creative, individualist ego that Thompson talks about starts to melt under the electric effect by 1900,
right,
maybe before. So the modernists that you just described are attempts to resuscitate the individualist creative genius and create what was later accused of being elitist art, difficult art, to reassert the uniqueness of the individual as it confronted this pop culture of electric media.
Right. Yeah, the key word here associated with Faulkner, Joyce, and Virginia Woolf is they attempted new ways of tracing the flow of characters' thoughts in their stream of consciousness style.
Yeah. So
the stream of consciousness is probably, you know, I guess that's not postmodern yet, but it's pretty close.
Stream of consciousness is the activity of the brain or the skull of the chemical body turned into an art form.
Mm-hmm.
The actual environment is not a stream of consciousness. It's a collective consciousness.
Mm. Right.
In the electric age.
Right. So it's the individual trying to assert himself in the...
Yeah.
You know.
And maybe even accused of going hyper-subjective and interior. Now, Joyce was accused of that, but nobody knew that he was miming the movie processes. I mean, maybe the rare Steed understood this, but generally Ulysses was difficult to understand and follow unless you really rehearsed it and practiced it and get an idea of what he was doing. But most people were still Gutenbergian and looked at it as that kind of novel, looking for a story. Then when he got into Finney's Wake with showing the flow of collective archetypes, oh, man, nobody knew what the hell he's doing.
Yeah.
And then they could fall back and kind of grasp Ulysses, but Ulysses logically led into the stream of collective consciousness, which is Finney's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
Not the stream of individual consciousness.
Right. Well, it was the nighttime consciousness of the collective.
Right. Yep. Daylight versus nighttime. And it's the... and then when you have television, you have day and night both times at the same time.
Yeah, that's quantum.
Yeah.
Because Croker's idea of the quantum is that you're holding two extreme positions simultaneously.
Yeah, that'd be schizoid.
Yeah.
Schizoid signs of Nietzsche and Bataille.
Mm-hmm.
So look at how Croker defines the postmodern in light of all that we've said. So read the first little paragraph of the section we're going to do.
What is postmodernism? It is what is playing at your local theater, TV studio, office tower, doctor's office, or sex outlet. Not the beginning of anything new or the end of anything old, but the catastrophic, because fun, implosion of contemporary culture into a whole series of panic scenes at the fin de millennium. And so, some panic, these as a seismographic of the postmodern mood.
And so some panic thesis, as a seismograph of the postmodern mood. So we're going to go through panic politics, panic money. These are the various panic thesis.
Right.
And the phrase was fin de millennium, that means end of the millennium.
Yeah, why do you think he chooses to put it italicized in French as opposed to just saying end of millennium?
Because that's, F-I-N is French for end, and it's fin de siècle.
But he chooses to say it in French, he could just have said it in English.
No, it's playing off the fin de siècle, the end of the century, so it becomes fin de millennium, and it has a French tradition. And it's a different language.
Right.
So you put it in italics, I guess.
Okay.
So what is postmodernism? So this is what it is. It is what is playing at your local theater, TV studio, office tower, doctor's office, or sex outlet. In other words, it's a whole, it's not just what's the content of a movie. There's no movie at the office tower, but it's the interacting of the, you could say, the discounted body with the chemical body.
Mm-hmm.
And the problems that result or the pleasures that result of that. Not the beginning of anything new or the end of anything old, but the catastrophic implosion of contemporary culture because it's fun celebrating the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the implosion of contemporary culture into a whole series of panic scenes at the end of the millennium, at the fin de millennium. Mm-hmm. And so some panic theses is a seismograph of the postmodern mood. So the postmodern is a mood. The mood that a movie projects, or a TV show, or the mood of an office, or the doctor's office. A lot of panic scenes. So panic is the main characteristic of postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the modernists tried to prop up the best of the pre-electric, and by the time you get the postmodernists, it's very hard to do. So you have writers who... have a hyper sense of put-on in how they perform their skills. they're almost, if they're doing traditional arts, they're totally indifferent to the audience. They're not even trying to be elitist. They're just writing for the fun of writing, or painting for the fun of painting, or using it just to make money so they can get into other media.
Yeah.
So let's read the Panic Politics. So what is postmodern politics? This is going to describe it.
It's fun time under the big top when the portable politicians of the postmodern parade come to the Herodic Dome.
As parody?
Yeah. The clones are out, wired to the computer consoles. Electronic waves piercing the body politic, agitating the crowd to glee with each melodramatic surge. Hooray, hooray, to that age of reversals, an age as Nietzsche describes it, that, quote, wants publicity, and that great actors, hub-hub, that great drum banging that appeals to the funfair tastes, unquote. It's time to get on the merry-go-round as quantum politics begins its spin under the barrage of particle beams from the repeating cannons of the cathode rays.
So let's read the next paragraph.
Postmodern politics begins with Mark Gettler's merry-go-round.
Painting called Merry-go-round, 1916.
Soldiers, sailors, and businessmen mount up on the automated carousel of hysteria. Each cloned in magical threes, mirrored images, breasts protruding, backs curved in the ellipse, and the ellipsoid arc ready for the high-speed chase. The horses are generally pure beyond...
Genetically
pure, beyond mutation, beyond cancerous errors of nature, poised for the viciousness of the war to come, a ready automated machine. Yet what is this? The protruding buttocks, rounded, open, and fleshy white, the solar anus open to the culture of fun/fear, ready to receive consummation as the carousel picks up speed.
Yeah, ready to take it up the ass. So what you have here, it's a, we won't go in to describe the image, but it's a, exactly what he's saying, but here's these people on horses going around and around, but their buns are exposed.
Right.
Protruding buttocks. Why that?
So right, one's
got it. But then you could go on to the next paragraph. It makes sense. He explains it.
Mm-hmm. Politics becomes the flashing anus of promises of the better world, constantly present as the carousel becomes the succession of white strobe-like flashes, and as the way system runs into the now of party time. The cries of the paraders, poised on the edge of aggression and terror, unable to dismount, caught in the imploding vortex of the fashion swirl, tunics pressed, hats in place, mouths open, ready for the distortion of the cyclorama.
Cyclorama. So you can read the next paragraph. It finishes it.
It is just this world of Gertler run now at hyperspeed, which, through the distorted images of the carousel, creates the holograms that characterize the political. The path of presidents or prime ministers trace/race after images across the nation. Cameras with open shutters hopeful that the celluloid will inscribe the sunny soul of the nation from the black hole of paranoid politics. Just as the video camera in the president's office oversees Red Square equally well as surveying the last troop movements.
The latest troop movements.
Latest troop. Instant on, instant politics, instant off.
So, does that communicate anything to you?
Panic politics, well, it's graphic metaphors. It's kind of raunchy. I don't know. What does it explain to you?
Well, don't you get a sense that it's an automatic operation? It's a hyper-ritual that is on automatic pilot and has very little human scale to it?
Yeah.
He's describing the automatic nature of the android meme in the world of the politics, with flashing media imagery, distorted images, and you see that creates the hologram that characterizes the political. There's your White House hologram.
Mm-hmm.
And the path of presidents or prime ministers race, trace and race after images across the nation. That's the pollsters looking for what the so-called quantum audience is interested in, and then try to mirror that. But they have to keep chasing in the hyperspeed of the 80s the polls.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a paranoid black hole of paranoid panic politics.
Yeah.
And then it's elections on, and then it's off. Instant on, instant politics, instant off. Then on something else.
Right.
So let me reread this. It'll make sense maybe as you're following it. Do it again. But it's pretty straightforward. You notice the phrase, quantum politics? There's that in there. The barrage of particle beams from the repeating cannons of the cathode rays. That's the media culture.
Oh, yeah.
Hyper-media culture of the 80s. When people are still imagining there is an audience for the politicians. Very hard to find it. It's different than the indifference of the population by the 90s, though some would say they were indifferent in the 80s, but massive indifference in the 90s and into this decade.
Well, it's because of the indifference that you say that there's no audience?
Yeah, the audience, politics is too puny. It's like the trying to organize a coherent image is around a bureaucracy and the boundaries of a nation are so marginal now that why would anybody pay attention to it?
But some people do, and it consumes 90% of all that the news talks about.
Right. And that's the doing more with less, the implosion into the word that makes a market. They all discuss it, Hillary or Giuliani right now, or Obama, you know, it's very, they're not discussing issues, they're discussing images that are racing across their screens.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason there's a lot of discussion is that talk radio and computers allow people to participate. So the audience is really talking about itself and arguing its own reactions. It's like the old McClune thing that there are more people covering the Vietnam War than fought in it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's more people involved in exchanging opinions to create a sense of community,
right,
community, in the media in the last 10, 15 years, and the number of issues they're discussing are very minuscule, but it's not the content that's important. It's the participation and the haggling.
Right.
Haggling of images, and how did so-and-so do in that debate? Not the politician, but just take Crossfire, or any Bill O'Reilly show. How did this guest do, you know, in the 3 minutes he was on encountering Bill O'Reilly?
Mm-hmm.
So this paragraph is describing the preliminaries to that in the 80s.
Yeah.
So it's politics is dead. No such thing to be a political over, but or to be political about, but therefore you have panic politics.
Right.
So what is it? It's a fun time, because everybody in the media makes money covering these images.
Right.
So it's fun time under the big top when the portable politicians of the postmodern parade come to the parodic dome. It's a parody of politics. The clones are out, not even human, wired to the computer consoles, electronic waves piercing the body politic, agitating the crowd to glee with each melodramatic surge. Hooray, hooray! To that age of reversals, an age, as Nietzsche describes it, that wants publicity and that great actor's hubbub, that great drum banging that appeals to its funfair taste, that you could say that's the people requiring content on the media. And since it gets more and more sport-like and competitive, politics is a good image to supplement or give a rationale to the essential competitive Olympics nature of daily commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And blogging. And each melodramatic surge, okay, some politician make some faux pas. Everybody talks about that for 3 days. Then there's another melodramatic surge. Some other issue comes up. Right?
Right.
So it goes on. It's time to get on the merry-go-round as quantum politics begins its spin. The particles are spinning. Under the barrage of particle beams from the repeating cannons of the cathode rays. Postmodern politics begins with Mark Gertler's merry-go-round, 1916. The soldiers, sailors, and businessmen mount up on the automated carousel of hysteria, each cloned in magical threes, mirrored, imaged, breasts protruding. I'll read that again. Each cloned in magical threes, mirrored, imaged, breasts protruding, backs curved in the ellipsoid arc, ready for the high-speed chase. The horses are genetically pure, beyond mutation, beyond the cancerous errors of nature, poised for the viciousness of the war to come, a ready automated machine. So he's talking about the Android meme automated level of politics here. Yet what is this? There's actually a human element, the protruding buttocks, rounded open and fleshly white. That would be everybody getting their shit together. The actual buttocks is the potential for scandal or for some smear on your image. So everybody's vulnerable, and then therefore you get into abuse, an abuse economy.
Uh-huh.
Not an economy based on use value or exchange value or symbolic exchange value. It's based on abuse. So politicians are the victims of this process, or their images are. The solar anus, open to, solar anus is quoting Nietzsche. The solar anus, yeah, am I right about that? Or Bataille, I can't remember. The solar anus, open to the culture of fun/fear, ready to receive consummation as the carousel picks up speed. So you have, remember you talked about ecstasy and catastrophe. Fun, fear, both happening, both within the realm of sensation. Politics becomes the flashing anus of promises of the better world, constantly present as the carousel becomes the succession of white strobe-like flashes, and as the waste system runs into the now of party time, pun on political parties. The cries of the paraders, poised on the edge of aggression and terror, unable to dismount, caught in the imploding vortex of the fashion swirl. Tunics pressed, hats in place, mouths open, ready for the distortion of the cyclorama. So, but another level, he's talking about politics is a time to celebrate. It's a modern Mardi Gras. Total irresponsibility, total hogging the media, and you run it now for 2 years when you're doing a presidential race.
Mm-hmm.
It's a time for goofing off. It's like a parade. It's
yeah.
a holiday.
Yeah. Well, especially early on right now where they're ramping up, you know, and the players are all beginning to take shape. And
you had no say in it.
Right.
You don't even think of having a say in it. You're just watching the Android meme create a spectacle. So just to finish it, it is just this world of Gertler, which was painted in 1916, run now at hyper speed. So that paragraph describing the horses and that, the carousel of hysteria, he's saying is even faster now
mm-hmm.
than what that painting showed 100 years ago. It's just this world of Gertler run now at hyper speed, which through the distorted images of the carousel creates the holograms that characterize the political. And we can assume holograms means is a put-down, maybe, and implies pseudo-reality. Not necessarily if you were McLuhan, but maybe Croker, he may understand that the hologram is not a pseudo-event. It's an actual effect of reality, of second nature. And so creates the holograms that some people might, that word might mean it's a trivialization of the political. But it is literally a hologram. So this world of Gertler run now at hyperspeed, which creates the holograms that characterize the political. The path of presidents, think of subatomic particles, the path of presidents or prime ministers, trace race, you know, you measure subatomic particles by their traces, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the polls are the registration of the trace race. The path of presidents or prime ministers, trace race after images across the nation. They're trying to even establish one image somewhere. Or claim that they're president of the White House. And with Bush, it became what do you call him? The president's elect, rather than the president-elect?
Oh.
Okay, cameras with open shutters, hopeful that the celluloid will inscribe the sunny soul of the nation from the black hole of paranoid politics. So the whole idea is to give people a sense of purpose around the image of the nation. So paranoid politics is hoped to flip into the sunny soul of some wonderful president and its image.
Mm-hmm.
Just as the video camera in the president's office oversees Red Square equally well as surveying the latest troop movements. Instant on, instant politics, instant off. So the cameras are overseeing the whole process, just as the White House oversees with satellite technology every part of the world, including the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So the opposition and the contender are complementary, yin-yang, inside a paranoid hyper-image search.
Right. So a couple of comments, one of which is that while you were reading that, I brought up Mark Gertler's merry-go-round of 1960, the painting on the Internet. And it's just astonishing, actually, that I can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, all information is available at my fingertips.
Yeah, this is your painting.
Yeah. Now you said that, you know, I don't have any part in the Android meme selection of images.
Not an image, but you can call up talk shows.
Yeah, or the selection of candidates and so on.
Yeah.
See, the assumption is that my representatives do, and that I voted for my representatives.
Right. But
so
they
there's
don't,
still this idea that we're in a participatory situation here.
Well, here's the thing. The bureaucracy that the president is running for, or a congressman, they want to sit in an old 19th century institution and process paperwork and have opinions and be part of a bureaucracy. We don't live in bureaucracy day to day in terms of the multimedia. So it's the real democracy is not represented by the elected elected representatives. The real democracy, the hyper-democracy, is the whole engagement and yelling and screaming on talk shows and polls and whatever media people get access to, magazine articles. There's the democracy. People talk about, you know, Bush brings in fascism. Well, that's a 19th century bureaucracy running around trying to create a sense of purpose. But the United States is so hyper-democratic in terms of participation, if you define that as democracy, that utopian vision of democracy that someone imagined 200 years ago has been exceeded beyond the wildest dreams of Voltaire or Plato or whoever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the participation in the other media, which is the election process, not the actual election itself.
Mm-hmm.
The election is just for someone to end up sitting on the margins in some bureaucracy. I mean, McLuhan wrote about this in Take Today in the early 70s, that most politicians just end up out of touch with everybody.
Yeah.
Once they're elected.
But bureaucracy is still at the foundation. I mean, no news institution would be out there with cameras. Nobody would be making cameras. None of this media would exist if there wasn't some bureaucracy at the root of it, which is a bunch of people, trying to make something happen and creating a lot of friction between themselves and, you know, somebody dominating with his idea, and then we all go this way, and then, you know, things get made and the lights get switches get turned on and it all happens.
Well, that's the ecology. You have black and you have white, so you have the electric hyper-democracy of the citizen engaging in different electric media, and then that's a decentralized situation, and that's complemented by the tradition of centralism. So the image of a bureaucracy goes hand-in-hand with the decentralized anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ecology of Western societies, mm-hmm. What we've built.
Right.
And it includes other non-Western societies, but they come later. The private identity that Gutenberg created, which is bureaucratic, is up against and complementary, and they feed off each other, in relation to the Marconi vortex. So the Gutenberg feeds off the Marconi. Marconi feeds off the Gutenberg. And whatever is determined quickly subsides and evaporates as the spin cycle, the cyclorama, continues. Because people need new content the next day on the media.
Mm-hmm. So, one of the things I was thinking about when we were talking about, you know, our level of participation in all this was that, what's the name of that organization that used to run all the polls? you know, to hook your TV up, and then when you watch stuff,
Nielsen.
Maybe, Nielsen, yeah. Do the Nielsen still? Are they still exist? I haven't even heard of them in 10 years.
I think so. I don't know what they do.
But remember, we're back in the 70s and 80s, everybody was aware of the Nielsen ratings. You know, that they were the ones who were taking the consensus temperature and then relating
overnight for the TV shows and everything.
Yeah.
Now, McLuhan said the Nielsen ratings was Big Brother. But Big Brother is no longer to dominate. So, yeah, the Nielsen ratings disappear and polling is unemployed.
How is polling even done anymore? Because shows are still, you know, still based on ratings. That's how they get the commercial dollars. It's like, well, we know, you know, this many people tuned into this segment of this show, and this is where, you know, so we can charge you, you know, $1,000 per minute for your advertising, you know, on this segment of this show or whatever. I mean, somehow they believe they know who's watching them and how many.
Well, I think it's staged. It's probably bought and paid for.
Uh-huh.
Bribery.
Mm. Yeah. Well, but still, shows have to compete. CNN has to compete with Fox and MSNBC, and all these shows have to, you know, if they're not going to have, if they are not drawing as much attention, juice from the public, then they're going to drop out, and it's going to be replaced by someone who does.
And it's a panic situation. It's panic Big Brother, because humans need, in our Western tradition, we need a centralized image of hierarchy and bureaucracy, or sense of someone's in control. So the ratings, the polls, are an arbitrary programmed image that must give the elites a sense of stability and a way of limiting the information overload. It actually has a service of saying, okay, we're not going to let everybody on here and anybody can broadcast anything. That's for public access. But we're going to keep it centralized and controlled and say, yes, this show, this person, Madonna, is a star for the next 3 years. Everything revolves around Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
Fashion, music, high school courses.
But that could only be as if she's resonating with what, you know, with what's happening.
Right.
She has to be. She has to resonate with the now, in order to be become the center of attention and fascination of the now.
Well, that's what you do. Is it's a bottom up effect. Whatever, there's lots of people that resonate. One gets picked. Often they say it's like a lottery. And then that one, and they have to be a contender. They can't be totally
obscure.
Unresonant with the popular look, the popular desire, mm-hmm. the resonant music industry texture. So once someone is selected, then they're repeated. And the need in humans to have a centralized image, as more and more since the 70s and 80s, the chaotic information overload threatened everybody's identity, then there's more balance back to, or more ballast put back on a centralized image. So therefore, the celebrity culture emphasizes someone as a central, important image, as a necessary, and the audience requires, feels a need for. Otherwise, they'd be panicking in the anarchy. Now they panic to find centralized imagery. So the new stars are guaranteed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of it comes out of Disney. You know, Britney Spears, a lot of these stars came out of Disney, early Disney shows, Mickey Mouse shows.
Yeah, going all the way back to Annette Funicello.
Yeah. I mean, Britney Spears, Justin Timberlake, I think, and a couple others, I'm not up on all of them, were all part of the Disney Corporation in some form or other.
Yeah, well, and because they lived the media when they were growing up, they're the only people that could actually probably tolerate being at the center of it right now.
Right, and if they are having
most people would have killed themselves a long time ago, but they grew up managing being in the media.
They're like clones.
Yeah.
What he says here, uses the phrase clones in here, remember? Where was that? The clones are out. Now, what's interesting is that in the post-information environment we're in now, this Disney programming is fragile. So you have Brittany and Anna Nicole Smith, or anyway, these people sort of cracking up, even though they're well conditioned to deal with it.
Well, the hyper media is getting. They're just saying, you know, the paparazzi, the need for information. It used to be the paparazzi needed a picture of these people once a month for People magazine. Now they need a picture every nanosecond because it's got to be on the web now, moment by moment. And so the amount of pressure, these people are being stalked. It's, you know, and in some cases their lives are being endangered because they're being run off the road by mad people with cameras that want to get their pictures. So, you know, it would be enough to crack anybody up.
That's right. And so the idea of a human dimension to the Android meme is long disappeared because it's the machine needs the imagery. And machine's not even a good word. The hologramic process needs subatomic particles. And so more and more people, look at reality TV or the American Idol, more and more of anybody. You don't have to have any talent. You just need to show up and be a content for the screen.
Yeah.
That's being hyper-processed by the Android meme's need to have imagery for its media complex.
Yeah. Now, when you spoke with Croker back probably 12, 24 months ago on Eben Ray's show, your first talk with him on Eben Ray's Radio Alchemy, that's A-L-C-H-M...
A-L-C-H-Y-M-Y.
Yeah, .com.
RadioAlchemy.com.
Yeah. He said something that really fascinated me, and I don't remember the exact terminology, so I'll just try to invoke it and see if I can get you to say what he was saying. But he was saying, you were talking about, the economists of the world, the political talking heads or whatever. Croker said they're all out of touch. They don't even know what's going on because what's driving the politics and the culture now is music. And it says it's the forms of music that are being created, the compositions, the rhythms, and all the various intonations or elements that go into music are what's driving the economy. And if you're an economist thinking in old terms, you're just propping up an old image to keep people comfortable. But you're not hip. You don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, you don't have to be hip. The old stick in the muds were on talk shows being verbal and talking ideas and concepts. They're a necessary part of the ecology because the average consumer would just be driven crazy by the emphasis on music or the fact that music runs everything. So they need that gives a lot of wealth and energy to the Crossfire shows, to the talk shows, to Rush Limbaugh. They're necessary balances for a person experiencing quadrophenia.
Right. So I guess cultures we're not ready to give in to the idea that we've lost control to 18-year-old punks that are creating new sounds in their basement.
Now remember, we had that in the Thompson section. He was talking about how the punks created a whole economy that put a lot of money into the British situation there that nobody created these.
Yeah.
Nobody sponsored these punks. They
right.
created their own world.
Yeah. And, he was saying, I remember him saying that Margaret Thatcher's, investing in the new billion-dollar helicopter for the military, and that's puny compared to what these guys are doing, in their basements. But still, there was the idea that they're creating music as an industry, not the radical Croker idea that they are at the fulcrum of the evolution of the or the ecology of the economy.
Yeah, it's like Croker when he was interviewed, he sort of became a slower pattern recognition. Process, slower pattern recognizer. And so he had to use words, so he talks slower cliches, but his writing goes way past that. It's not as stodgy.
Goes past the idea that music is now evolving the economies.
Well, the idea that music was hip and these guys are out of TED touch, he would consider them all Android meme processors.
Yeah.
Both the hip music...
Well, it was I overlaid the word hip. He didn't say that. He was just saying that the creation of new music is what is driving the economy. that there's no relationship between old causal terms where we think of, you know, industries driving the economy.
When he says music, what that means, that's a seamless web of media, the word that makes the market, but it's a guitar solo word. And music is a good image of a seamless web.
Oh. So he wasn't talking about somebody creating a new hip-hop song.
No, he meant that the changes, I don't think I have the quote in the book, but he has this great quote he did in the early 90s in maybe the book Spasm, where he talks about the phases from heavy metal to new wave to country music or rap, hip-hop, all the phases of music fads over the last 25 years from, let's say, late 60s up to early 93 were actually representative of moods in the satellite tactility and then the Android meme phase. They express the moods of people's physical quantum lives more than any painting, movie, or ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So the music, the mood, the style of music reflected the textures of the media mix at the time.
Right.
But here's what Thompson says. If you really believe in nuclear power, hawk your spouse and your mortgage and your house and take everything you've got and buy shares in Wilco. You'll have it coming to you in what you'll get from that kind of capitalism. But now look at what these funny teenagers have done. They've created a music industry, a magazine industry, a fashion industry, and a music video industry. Add up all the informational transactions from that planetary culture of information and divide it by the dole, and you'll see an incredible return on investment. But we don't look at these kids as the J.P. Morgans and captains of industry of the modern world. We look at them as parasites, aliens, predators, and the rest of it. That's because we can't see punk as the working class transformed into an art form. These kids are smarter than Maggie.